And the subject is chemical dependency prevention and treatment. With a topic like this, there are just 1,000 directions we can take our hands. And the main thing I'd like to say to you, yes, I do have an agenda. Yes, I do have a sense of direction. However, if you direct me in a different direction from my agenda, I will follow your lead. It's an area that I'm very excited about. I've been involved in for 18 plus years with adults at the adult level and at the youth level. It's an exciting and a challenging area because youth is the present future. The present future of our society. And of course, without the adults, the youth won't make it. So I have a heavy investment both ways. I direct a program primarily, my basic job on a daily basis is directing a youth drug and alcohol outpatient counseling program in Tacoma, Washington. That's been in operation for 15 and a half years. I did bring some propaganda about Alpha House. So if you'd like to have a copy of this, I have several handouts, but my understanding is that copying is limited here. So if you write your name on a handout, I will see that enough copies are made. So tomorrow morning before I jump on the bus, I can leave you with some copies of the various things. One of the first things I'd like to get out of the way, because everybody wants to know that. What are the signs and symptoms? And I'm going to talk about this only because it's a high priority question, but I really don't like it. And I'm going to tell you why I don't like it. The signs and symptoms of substance abuse is identical to so many other signs and symptoms until it's easy to become a little policeman and come up with the wrong conclusion in terms of your child or your significant other, and even yourself. Some of the very same things that happen to a youngster who is in the developmental process of becoming a person. It's normal for a 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old in our society to stop being interested in doing things with mom and dad and want to look in the other direction. Nothing's abnormal about that. It's normal for a teenager all of a sudden with other distractions not to be as interested in their schoolwork. That's part of the process. However, because it's such a serious area, we do need to be aware of some of the normalities of our children's group development process and which one of those relate to drug and alcohol substance abuse. Some very common things, some of which many of you may already be aware of, and others might be slightly enlightened. One of the main things initially, this is not for a person who has smoked a joint or had a couple of drinks. This is for someone who has begun to establish some type of pattern of use and abuse of chemicals. Okay? One of the things is weight loss significantly or weight gain. Now, in order for you to be able to determine that, you have to first what about the person?
Know what they wear.
You have to first know the person. Yeah. So when I talk about prevention, and especially with kids, I say to the adult world, the first thing we have to do is to get to know our young people. And I have many parents say to me, oh, I know my kid. Oh, I know him. I know him like a book. But they really didn't know they was failing in school. They really didn't know they didn't like spinach. They really didn't know they hate their uncle because you never allow them to express that. You never took time to listen to their feelings and who they are. So one of the first things we have to do is know what our children's likes and dislikes are. We need to know what their patterns of sleep, Not what time they went to their room, but we have some idea about whether they sleep a 6-hour night, an 8-hour night, a 12-hour night, what's normal for that kid. And that's what prepares us to be able to determine whether this is an indication that something is wrong. So weight loss, significantly weight gain. Change in school attendance. Even to the degree, the kid who has not been going to school, all of a sudden start going. Now, most of us would jump for joy, you know, but that could be an indication that there's another attraction there other than young ladies or the books. Okay. And you need to check that out. Personality changes. A kid who used to be very outgoing and forward and involved in life and all of a sudden begin to, and I use the term all of a sudden because we don't really notice it in the earlier stages. All of us, we say, it just happened last week, but really started 2 months ago, or 6 months ago, sometime even a year ago when you begin to process it. But mood changes. Used to be forward and outgoing, and now we have such a quiet, passive, withdrawn individual. Or the reverse. We had a very withdrawn individual, and now he's just bouncing all over the place. Just like everybody. Peace, colors, everything is cool. Yeah. That kind of stuff. You know, changes in behavior. And you have to stop and observe. Reduction in meaning. A lot of people who are involved in substance abuse on any kind of consistent basis have a very poor memory of some very common basic things. Now, oftentimes the things they remember well. So sometimes they'll be talking about last year, last month, and if it's their topic, they're right on target. But when you start referring to other events and times and places and people that they probably should be aware of, maybe space out on you. Huh? What'd you say? Uh-huh. Yes. And if you're not alert that they're not really answering you, you can go on with that for how long? Years. So we need to know our young people. Increased illnesses. One of the things that happened with substance abuse, and that is your immune system really breaks down. And you become more susceptible to the viruses that's around. And especially when you have some consistency of involvement and your eating patterns drop off, your rest patterns drop off, you're not getting what your body needs. Your resistance is down. And so you become open to whatever is in the air. And so they may keep a cold. They may catch what every other family member had. And everybody else is doing well, but it seemed like this one person seemed to come down with it. It's in the air. disappearance of money and valuables. Oh, I lost. Most of us do not lose your diamond ring 1 week, your radio the next week, and your coin collection the next week. Yeah. Now, we all lose things, so I'm not saying assume that something is misplaced, you can't find it, you jump on the significant other of the kid. But when you begin to see a pattern of things being missing, something is wrong. Now, mind you, I say something is wrong. I did not say that's a drug or alcohol. That is what you have to find out. But you do know that something is wrong. Going to odd places. You know, going out and sitting in the backyard and nobody's out there for hours. Going down in the basement that hasn't been cleaned up in who knows when. Oh, I just feel like. It's quiet down here, but so is the rats and, you know. that's not, for most of us, it's not normal behavior. It's kind of odd. Another thing that I don't have on this list is when they begin to selecting new and different friends and have no desire for you to be aware of who they are. And oftentimes, when they begin to select older friends, and when it doesn't make any difference whether it's a male or female. Now, sometimes for young fellas, they get interested in an older female. That's not drug abuse. And sometimes for young ladies, they get interested in an older fella. That's not automatically drug abuse. But when they have these older secret friends that may or may not be male or female, it's time for you to take note, if you haven't been taking note already. Odors in the house that you don't recognize. Now, everybody's house smell. You know, we have our own smell. You know, and when that changes, you know, I don't know, I haven't met a kid yet whose room does not have an odor. Unless you clean it up every day. Okay, make a habit of going in there and passing by that door and sniffing. Now, I know some of you have a very strict rule that the kid has a right to privacy and all this kind of stuff. And if that's your rule, you know, fine. But at least pass by the door and take a sniff every once in a while and see what's different, if anything. And then, again, as soon as you notice a strange odor, it's not automatically drugs. He might have found a strange perfume that he thought worked magic. And that's, you know, putting it all over his body. But check it out. And of course, the obvious signs when a kid come in and doesn't have his or her equilibrium. They really can't stand up straight. Or when they can't focus. When they just stop looking you in the eye when you talk. Changes is what you're looking for. And mind you, I cannot stress enough that all of the things on this list, just like the common cold, it could be 101 reasons. So we're not talking automatic, but we are talking about red flags to go up for you to begin to be concerned. All over the country, you will find stuff like this that gives a list of drugs, effects, duration, and all that kind of stuff, the method of intake into the system. And it's a healthy little tool. I say it's a healthy little tool because it helps you to not only know terminology, but to talk to your young people in a sensible fashion about substance and substance abuse, and particular drugs. And since most of us are not pharmacists, and we have not really knowledgeable in pharmacology, we need a reference point. And this is a very good one. And if you desire it, write your name on the back, and we'll get some copies of that. I'm getting these things out of the way because, as you know, once I get talking, I just go on and on and on, and you may not get to be aware. This type of literature is available all over. Now, I don't have copies of them for you, but you can write down the source. Some of it's free, and others you get it in bulk, and you can get real cheap. But it's good, practical information and some very reliable sources. This group company deals with the latest in street terminology of drugs. So if you have young people that you're concerned about, and you've been sitting around listening to them, listen to what they're talking about.
Where would this stuff really be available? I've never seen any of it. Is it in the drugstores or?
What, this?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, they sent it to me because I'm in the business.
Yeah.
But why don't you just copy it down and write the company? They have an auto blank in each one of them and price, and they'd be love to get your money. But a lot of the schools have them. A lot of the prisons have them. A lot of the hospitals have them just out on the counter. Any of the drug and alcohol, inpatient, outpatient, information referral programs have them. Community colleges and even four-year colleges and university have sections now that they have this kind of information available. You can go to the health department, and they would have you go to the police department, and they have a section in various counties. You can go to the insurance companies, because a lot of the stuff that I get and use out, because I give so much out, I got to look for free places to get mine. And a lot of the insurance companies are pumping out information like this that's available. And you just have to ask for it in a lot of cases. We are just about to go into doing your analysis at my agency, and the chemical company that's producing the machine that we're going to use pumps out tons of stuff and is propaganda to us to induce us to buy their, use their machine. They give us all we, you know, ask for. So it's all around, but perhaps you haven't had a need for it, no, a conscious need for it. So sometime the Ferrari is right in front of you, but if you don't know it's a Ferrari, it's gone. Okay. Two other things. This little doobie is very good and it's free. And if you get on the telephone and call the 800 number in the back of it, they will send you, I think it's 10 or 12 copies. And it's some very good information that what works, schools without drugs, and talk about parents' roles, community involvement, small group involvement, the school role, how you can intertwine between the two. Some very good information. It's not a Bible, but it's very good information, and it's relatively current. And these little guys, for every drug in the market, they have these little booklets, little comic type books. And again, some very good, straightforward information to equip you to talk intelligently. Now, I don't suggest you take this out with your teenager, because the first thing you're going to look at how the pictures and stuff, and you know what it looks like. It's elementary. Now, they do have some that's a little bit more sophisticated, but they don't get much more sophisticated than this. This is for you. So you can, in a very simplistic way, understand some of the substances and then begin to deal with them. Prevention is kind of a threefold animal. Prevention deals with you starting out when your kids are small, before they develop a habit. Prevention involves communicating to your child that you love them in terms of the degree that you hug and kiss and reinforce, the degree that you protect them from outside influences and harm and danger, the degree that you discipline them to confine to some kind of guidelines of discipline. One of the main characteristics that's common in a lot of young people, regardless of the socioeconomic strata that they come from, is the fact that they have no sense of boundaries. They're free-flowing entities. Many times, even though you think you raised them, they raised themselves, and probably you too, in many cases. But the concept of structure, of discipline, is not part of their life. Except for the kid who sells and pushes. Usually that's a pretty disciplined person, you know. And if they're, a few of them are pretty smart, they will sell, but they won't take it. You know, kind of stuff. But we're talking about communicating a sense of bonding and belonging and family security. You know, what does it mean to be a Horton? And when your family, when you say to your child, you are Johnson, you are Jackson, you are Higginbottom, you are whatever, what does that mean? What are you really saying to the kid? Anybody?
Pride.
You belong.
Family. What else?
Self-worth.
Respect.
Okay, beautiful. How much respect do we give our kids? How much do we demonstrate behavior that our kids can be proud of?
Not much.
How fair are we in dealing with our kids?
Not
To what degree have we taught our kids to respect their own property and property of others? And as a society, we've done a very poor job of that. So we have a whole group of kids who don't have that sense of pride, family belonging, self-worth and self-identity, and a sense of I'm somebody and I'm going someplace. Many, more and more young people are saying, I don't want to be like my mom and dad. Now, when I was a kid, they used to say, well, they were square. And I'm not really sure what the term today is because it changes quickly, you know. But the equivalent is there. How many of you cheat on your income taxes and laugh about it? How many of you run the red light and laugh about it? How many cheat on your neighbors and laugh about it? Who's listening? One of the things Ron was saying this morning, that kids are watching, and their reality is what they see and what that means to them. And when they look at us, too often, they do not see somebody that they can look up to and respect because they know our weaknesses. And many of us have too many weaknesses. We all have some, but many of us have too many that are quite obvious. How often do we allow our young people to hear us talking about the pastor's wife, the deacon, the chairman of the finance committee, you know, God, in negative terms? And as a society, when we look at government, I mean, that's a total chaos, fiasco. So what is there that we're giving young people to engender this pride and their self-worth and belonging? For a large number of the young people in our population, we're not doing it. Now, fortunately, we're not total failures. No, because some parents are doing a wonderful job and even helping a neighbor. But yet we have too many. So why are we concerned about the too many? The reason why we're concerned about the too many is that none of us have a crystal ball that we can tell which kids will be like some of the people we knew when we were in high school and in college, and every Friday and Saturday night they used to do what?
Get drunk.
And 10 years later, they're successful in business, they're married, relatively good parents, and they grew out of it. And some young people will grow out of the drug situation. They will just pass through with few scars. But we don't know who will, and we don't know who won't. But there are some things that we do know. The research tells us that if a person become a drug or alcoholic around 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, and around 20, 30, or 40 years old go into treatment and do well in treatment, and come out of treatment about 42 years old, a recovered alcoholic, a recovered drug addict, at 42 years old, this person has an emotional age of approximately what?
14.
Somewhere in there where they got started. And here we have a person that's 42 years old, supposed to be getting a new start in life and move it in a positive direction, and nobody wants to associate with him. Why?
He acts like a baby
on one hand. And so if he come to date your 18-year-old daughter, what are you going to do? No. Any of us. And if he come to date you, and you 42, what are you going to do? Rejection. You know. Those are lost years emotionally. Now, yes, there's some work that can be done to help them regain, recapture, and come up emotionally up to his chronological age, but that's a lot of additional work and time. And usually they get very little cooperation and support from society at large in that process. That's why we take every situation, and I would challenge you to take every situation serious. until you find out that it is not serious. Because young people could lose a significant portion of their lives. And it's not a problem that just, as we know, just affect the individual. Most of the work that's being done today is being done in terms of family therapy, family treatment. Everybody's affected. The little ones. We've even given names to all of the members of the family now as to the roles that they play and how it impacts them. We have many programs for adult children of alcoholic, let me get that right, children, adult children of alcoholic families. And they're going back, identifying the hurt, the frustration, the misery, the guilt, the shame, and dealing with that, freeing themselves of some of that garbage so that they can begin to respond to the men or the women or the children in their lives more appropriately. It's a very serious thing. Once a person gets involved in drugs and alcohol abuse, we normally say a person, society normally says a person cannot be helped until what? Until they want it. How many of us agree with that? Raise your hands high. Okay, put them down. How many of us sometime agree with that? Okay. How many of us do not agree with that? Why not?
Because I think that mostly they want to be freed of their problem. Mostly they know, and I think we need to tell them. I think we need to tell them that they're in trouble and not wait for them to die. Which sometimes they do. I mean, some people never hit bottom. They die.
No, that's true. That's true.
Well, isn't it a matter of now they have techniques that they get around the denial that's so prevalent?
And that's the way I'm going. You know, I do agree that a person has to want help before the real work begins. Mm-hmm. However, that does not mean we sit around and say, when you're ready, let me know, and then we'll start working on this. Right.
That's another gesture.
No. We need to learn intervention techniques. We need to learn how to stop supporting people who are substance abusers. We need to learn how to give ultimatums to people who are substance abusers. And I don't mean closed ultimatums. I mean open ultimatums. If then, if you do this, then this will happen. And that's a guarantee that that would happen. If you do this, then I will go with you all the way and mean it. If you do this, then these kind of things are available to you. And if you do not do this, what? It's not available. Yes, sir.
I was given, I've been through a number of treatment centers, inpatient and outpatient both. Mm-hmm. The first three or four were all court ordered. And of course, my ultimatum was prisoner treatment. Mm-hmm. I still would go through immediate relapse upon release of all those treatment centers. Until my last treatment center that I went through, which I voluntarily went, and I've been clean ever since. Mm-hmm. Within that period of time, I had a number of family counselors, parole officers, everybody trying intervention techniques with me, doing the ultimatum technique, if you will. Mm-hmm. I pushed harder against that.
True.
Then it was like, oh, so you're putting conditions on your love for me. Of course, I had just sort of failed at that period of my life, and yet I look back and can't help but see certain elements of truth within that. That tough love, too, but still it was a conditional type of thing.
True.
And My own personal testimony, until I've wanted help, I don't feel that I was treatable.
What brought you to the point of wanting help?
Well, I don't think we have enough time.
Okay. Maybe, no, good. No, that's good. Maybe that's my point.
It was just...
My point is that we do not stop working with people. We do not stop providing a system and a structure. We do not stop putting clear support systems out there, but not support systems that reinforce directly the use and abuse of drugs. And even though the person fight back, we in treatment have done a disservice to you, the users of the service, in defining what rehabilitation is. And we say that rehabilitation is a 30-day, a 40-day, a 60-day wonder.
Spin drive.
Right. And that's ludicrous. If you break your leg and go through rehabilitation, what happens? It's a period of therapeutic treatment. And that may be anywhere from, 3 months to a year plus. You're saying we can deal with a chronic situation in a crisis, with a crisis technique. And that's not true.
Although I, a certain element that I would have to disagree with a little bit, because my first treatment center I went through, immediately I walked out the doors and went and got loaded, but I'll tell you something, it was miserable. Because I had all this head knowledge of what I was doing to my body, what I was doing to society, what I was doing to my family, and I couldn't get enough to escape what I had just been through, 21 days of intense pounding down my throat either. So there was... There are some benefits.
Point,
yeah, there is... There was a long-term effect.
And when I speak in terms of treatment, I speak in terms of a process. A rehabilitative process. In some cases, an habilitative process. Some people have not been where you want to get them to. But it's a process. And there are several components to the process. One is establishing an appropriate support system. The moms and dads and the do-gooders that are out there who really want to save you. There's some approaches to that they need to be exercising. The treatment center itself, many of the rules that we have are designed to kick you out, not keep you in. Because if anybody, is there anybody in this room that's never been on a diet? You've never been on a diet? God bless you.
That's right. God has blessed us.
But for the rest of us, no, seriously, but for the rest of us who've been on a diet 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 times, how many relapses did you have?
4, 5, 10 times.
And all I'm saying, how many times did you cheat while you was on the diet? But the way we structure program for people with substance abuse problems, there's no room for them to cheat or to relapse, as we call it, in treatment. And if you do, what happens?
You're out.
And that's totally unrealistic. Habilitation and rehabilitation is a process. And part of that process should give consideration to the reality that there will be some relapses. Now we should be measuring the duration, the circumstances that lead to those relapses, and the experience of the person, and use those experiences to build on the additional treatment process. But not kick them out, like we have structured most of our programs to do. So I'm not saying, i.e. tough love is the answer. I'm saying tough love is a component of the answer to working with the problem. Oftentimes, tough love is what gets you into that door initially. Now, you don't want to be there, but because the court said you will, or because mom or dad, who have more authority than they realize they have, said you will, and you are, that gets you in the door. And my contentions are, at that point, it becomes incumbent upon the treatment agency to use their little grab bag of techniques to help you come to the place of, yes, I want some help.
Yes. Back when you were talking about the ultimatums, and right at the end they said, the other side, if you do not wish for some of these, you left it sort of for us, and then I heard some, and then you're out of my love type of things. And then you said, plain avoidance or something. I'm not, I'd like just for you to finish what,
okay.
Would the other ultimatum be that then I don't accept you anymore? Is that, that doesn't seem right.
Yep,
but.
It doesn't seem right, but the alternative might be, you cannot live here anymore. The other ultimatum is, I will not pay your bills anymore. I have been a part of this problem too long, and I've been supporting you in the problem too long. And if you choose to continue in the problem and will not let me be a part of some kind of resolution with you, yes, I've blown it, and I share some of the responsibility and some of the guilt, but at this point, I'm not going to support that any longer. Now, immediately, when there's some kind of evidence that you want to make a change, the same door that you walked out of is open. And I mean it, don't, you know. So if they call you at 3:00 in the morning, what? You respond. And don't give them a 50 question, you know, there as if, you know, you respond. And if they show that, hey, this just happened to be one of those low points and like it's common, okay, Lou, fine. I'll meet you for coffee. We can talk about it and see what you want to do, how we can help. And if it's clear that they're not ready to move, okay, it was nice having coffee, you know, let me know. Well, can I just come back in and move in and next week I'll make contact with the program? No, you make contact with the program, do what you can to get in, and then we'll talk about you moving back in. Yes, ma'am.
I had just wondered how, other than that open door, how other ways you could express love and not rejection to that person. Because, I mean, that ultimatum is not a rejection of the person, but of their behavior, right?
Yes.
And I was wondering, in your experience, what could have happened to sort of lessen the rejection that you felt, or the lack of love that you felt contingent upon your actions.
Is that directed to me or to?
And both, sorry.
Okay, you go first.
Well, I had, probably part of my problem was that my family was very, my only ultimatums really came from the court. My family supported me, ignorantly supported me. They'd bail me out with so many messes and so many jams, and financially and everywhere else, you know. It started off with a wife calling sick, and it got to the point where after the marriage was gone, that it was, you know, dad bailing me out of jail, dad putting his house up to get me out of jail at certain points. Just reels. And it was, he didn't know how to, I needed those ultimatums, I guess. I look back and reflect on now, and I didn't really, the only time I got them was from the court system.
So. I don't know of any way of convincing somebody at that stage that you love them, other than giving them what they're asking for. And then you're doing what?
You're perpetuating the problem.
Yes.
You can do things though, like you still invite them to family, you know, they're there for a couple hours or something.
Okay.
But they're still included in the family, and you still call them with the news of the family. So it's like you don't close them out, you just say you just are gone now, I guess you still are a person, we still care about you. And actually, I find that they don't care about a lot of family, so the family, I mean, that's just where they're at.
Yeah.
But that I'm, you know, that I'm still making that effort.
Okay, I didn't have that on my list, but fantastic. Fantastic.
This sounds much like the symptoms of an alcoholic, not Is there any differentiation between alcoholism and the other type of drug abuse, marijuana? Or?
There are a lot of differentiations, but when you get to the point of habituation, uh-huh. and it's a problem, getting people into treatment is the same. Denial is denial. And most of us say, we can what? I can handle it. I can stop when?
Anytime
I want. It's not hurting anybody but who?
Yeah.
If it's hurting me, it's not hurting anybody but me. So, what you uptight about? The alcoholic, the pot, the crack, you know, whatever it is. At that point, when you're looking at intervention. Now, yes, there are some teams around now that will pick you up and take you to a particular place and work with you until you say the right things. If it works, I think, as ugly as it sounds, I'm in favor of it. And the reason I'm in favor of it, because continuously I see the other end of people who just out there on the street. And I've had many parents to just go and go and go until they die. And when they die, there's a whole lot of hurt left in that family. I've seen a lot of kids die. And there's a whole lot of hurt and anguish left in that family. Lots of work to be done. And so personally, I think what happens if there isn't an intervention is more devastating on more people than the rights of that individual that's being imposed upon by forcing them to say, I want some help. That's a really tight issue for a lot of people. And each one of us really have to make up our decision individually as to the right and wrong and moral and immoral of that. But for where I stand, if it helps the person, I'm for it. In that regard. So when we talk about getting a person ready for treatment, let me focus a little bit more on kids. The same thing can happen with adults, but it just takes a little bit more sophisticated technique than this. We get a lot of kids into treatment who don't want to be there. The school told them you can't come back to school unless you get in the treatment program. Parents have said you can't get back in the house unless you get in the treatment program. The court said you're going to jail unless you get in the treatment program. So there's a lot of motivations to why they come. One of the little simple techniques that we use that's not new, it's not new by a long shot. Many of you have seen it in different forms, but it's amazing how it gets the young people to thinking about what's happening in their lives. One thing we do, is that we use cheap pencils. Is the drug alcohol test that we do is designed to give us some indication of the degree of involvement. And there are basically four categories that we would place someone in. The first would be use. That's it. S-U-S-E. What, 19 years of college? The first is use, and normally a person in this category is someone who, when they say, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, that's about what it is. And we're talking about an education session, we're talking about a family conference session, and some reinforcers for the family, but basically we're not talking about treatment. The next section is misuse. And misuse is when they're beginning to be some kind of a pattern to the person use. Either the pressures at home is too much and it helps me. The teachers are bugging me and it keeps me in class all day. My girlfriend is whatever and it, you know, there's some reasons why some sociological reasons usually why the person is doing it. As we identify these re-sociological reasons, we don't deal with substance abuse, we deal with the sociological reasons behind that. And again, as far as drug abuse is concerned, we don't view this as a real serious area once we can deal with the presenting problems. And it's amazing how many kids are unwilling to do this, because usually at this stage, the signs and symptoms of drug abuse and the problems associated with it is not pronounced enough in their lives for them to say, yes, I have a problem. And worst of all, the problem is not pronounced enough for the parents to say, yes, my kid have a problem. Parents have more, equally as much or more denial going on in these earlier stages than the kids do. I love to get a kid in this stage or this stage. This is abuse and addiction. And when we get to the stages of abuse and addiction, there are two common denominators that's taking place. Kids have to support their own habit at that point. Up here, friends and loved ones sometimes providing the drugs to them. But when you get here, you got to earn it. How do young people, even old people for that matter, finance a drug alcohol addiction?
Steal, sell, work, and dealers.
Usually between prostitution or stealing. You know, for the average, this is going to tell on some of you. For the average prostitute, how much kid prostitute, how much can they make in a night? Just guess if you don't know.
$100.
$1,000.
$150.
Okay. Easy. Kids are hot items, boys and girls. And what I get paid an hour is chicken feed to what they get paid an hour. Kind of thing. But they really can go from about a poor night could be $500, but they can knock out that. How much ever do they get to keep?
None. By the time they sell.
Just about. Or maybe 50, you know, 50 down, dollars down. Someone with that's really a drug addict and addicted to alcohol as well, and they're stealing. And they break into the lady in the yellow's house, and they take, in the yellow shirt, she didn't like that one. But they take her mink stole, and they take her silver flatware set, and they take the color TV, and they take her husband's entertainment center. All together. Glad I got him in there. His computer, okay. And all together, they may have about what? A value, they stole an estimated value of how much?
$500.
$6,000. What?
$5,000.
What do you mean?
Oh, who's thinking computer?
$5,000.
$1,500.
Yeah.
$5,000. Computer's $3,000.
It's used.
That's what you pay for.
That's what you pay for it initially,
well,
but it's used
about
now.
What they can get for this.
Yeah.
No, what it's worth.
What it's worth. What it's worth. Or even that. No, what it's worth is the one we want. Okay. How much do you think they're going to get?
$200.
If they're lucky. You know kids who can't read and write and do mathematics? Mm-hmm. You know what they can figure out real quickly?
I'm not
getting ripped off. That's right. And when they realize they're being ripped off, now I didn't say that, did I? I just put the figures on the board. How much do you make when you work? How much do you get when you work? And you can go through this process, and they begin to say, huh, who's the good guy here?
You are, because you're...
No, not in that sense. Oh. Not in that sense. In terms of the people in his or her life that they have been looking up to.
The ones that give them the
their
trust.
Buddies. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, their buddies are the ones who are ripping them off. So who do they get angry with? Okay. And usually, when someone helps you see that someone else is taking advantage of you, what kind of relationship do you immediately begin to bind with him? You become the friend. And the door is open for intervention. You get him angry. But you direct the anger at the appropriate source without saying it. And sometime in marriage counseling, you do the same thing. You get them angry at the appropriate source. And sometimes the appropriate source is themselves. You know? But when you do that, rather than I'm the bad guy trying to make you do something you don't want to do, trying to make you stay in a program you don't want to stay in, all of a sudden, I become your friend, your helper. And one common statement is, well, what can I do about it? How can I get them? Say, stick around a little while and we'll work on that. You know. And we have a person who did not want treatment, have evolved to the point that the door is open. Now, I'm not saying they're 100% so. You still got a whole lot of work to do, but you got the door open. So that's why I speak to both sides of my mouth. No, a person doesn't have to be saying, yes, I want treatment right away. On the other hand, before they say, yes, I want treatment, treatment really does not begin. Yes, sir.
I'm wondering, that must be a late stage. I'll take the prostitution thing. That male or female's got a pimp. And let's assume Terrell. Okay, he's giving her sheet fix every day. And that's who cares? She don't care if she's turning $2,500 a night in a trip, and he's, as long as she's got an outfit in her arm. So how long does that have to go before she becomes even aware that she's bitter? I'm using some, and he just...
Yeah, no. Some cases it happens in that first session.
In the early stages of that?
Yeah. In fact, in our setting, most of it is. When you can show a person that they're being ripped off without saying you're being ripped off, as if the light bulb is coming out of them, they're much more receptive than if I say, hey, look, don't you see what he's doing to you? Nah. No, we don't do that. What's happening in your life? Let's take a look at it. How is it working? I said, no problem. I get everything out. Well, no, fine. There's some other things we can do. And that's why I use the term. It may not sound professional, but it's real. I use the term, once they get to the treatment program, it's up to the treatment program to use their grab bag of exercises to bring about some cooperation. We might take tissue paper, we might take brown paper, we might write on the floor. We've even written on the walls, to my regret at times, because I'm the director of the program and I got to see that the walls get clean. But sometime, just in talking with kids, you might use a term when they first come in and they're hostile and whatnot and uncooperative. You just talk, kind of talk. And in the process, this is what you're doing right now. But when you get to be 20 years old, what kind of money do you want to be making? You know, this is good. This is good for right now. It's working for you. So I'm not putting you down. Okay. But when you get to be 20 years old, kind of money you want to be making. You know? And a lot of kids would say anywhere from $80,000 to $100,000. Is that right?
One more zero?
Yeah. A year. And that's, I don't laugh at them. Why? Because it's not unrealistic. And then you ask him, you know, it's just a conversation, no big deal. What kind of car you want to drive? And you'd get a price tag. What kind of clothes you want to wear? And they'd get a price tag. All these things are important to them. And you add it up. What are you going to do different in your life that 10 years from now I'm going to bring that back? Get the discussion going. You don't give them answers. You draw from them answers. And you record them as you go. Yeah. And as you get this stuff down, you begin to talk about things like, this is where you are. This is where you say you want to be. What kind of jobs will provide that? I don't want to be, no, we're not saying that's what you want to be. Just what kind of jobs do you know that would provide that? You don't fight them, but you keep them moving in a direction. What are the qualifications for these jobs? Now, if you're really serious about how you want to live, these are some things you have to look at. This is where you are. This is where you want to be. And these are some of the natural hurdles that have to be crossed to get there. And we always start from the top, working down. And by the time we get down here, in most cases the kid is saying, well, I guess I have to get myself straight. The door is open for treatment to begin. All of this is just preliminary stuff. And this could take one, two, or three sessions. Depends on the skill of the therapist and the kind of the kid that we're working with. Yes, ma'am.
With the case of prostitution, is the subject of AIDS ever brought up?
Oh, yes. In fact, in Washington State, there's a requirement that for every person that come in for a drug alcohol evaluation has to be given a brief AIDS orientation. How it can take... contacted, the effects on the system, resources that are available for treatment, and precaution.
Well, when you're talking about all of this, do you say, hey, you might not even live to make
no,
your $80,000
no,
a year?
No. Because our experience says, as soon as you throw something up like that, the kids throw up their hands and say, forget you. I'm not going to get AIDS. My pimp takes care of me in that. I get my checkups. You know, kind of stuff. And so the goal, one of the goals is for the therapist not to antagonize the person until they get to the point of beginning to agree and open up, you know. And when we get to the AIDS part, look, John, you may not be interested in this, but the law says I got to do it. And if I don't do it, I'm not going to get paid. You understand that, don't you?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you get off the hook by using the
lock. That's right. But you keep the kid in the room.
Right.
Because if you pop up AIDS on them and start talking about this stuff and this is going to happen, that's going to happen, they're going to do what? Forget you, man.
Some of them could probably tell you everything on there.
That's true. And I tell them, if you know it already, go along with me with it. We get it over quick. And that's it. And all I'm saying is, there are ways to get the message over without antagonizing the person. And in most cases, you keep the process going until they are hooked into, well, yeah, I'll come back next time.
high school teacher, and I know that kids never think it'll happen to them.
Yes.
They never think they're going to get pregnant. They can just do it one time. It won't happen to me. I won't get pregnant. They never think they're going to get pregnant.
No. Yes, sir.
I would just confirm what you said. We have to avoid being judgmental.
Mm-hmm. Let me give you a couple of other things right quick, because I run my mouth so time's running out. I'm confident that either most of us at some point is going to need to know how to select a decent drug alcohol treatment program, either for someone in your family or for someone in your immediate family, extended family, or circle of contacts. Several things I think you need to look for in selecting a treatment program. One is a treatment program that will say, yes, I will see you like within 2 or 3 days at the maximum. Anything along with that, you need to look somewhere else. Why? Because the person's not going to hang around that long. That's number one. Number two, you need to be looking at a treatment program that when they start talking about doing an evaluation on you or the person you're referring, there's a combination of things that they do, not necessarily in this order, but they all need to be done. The first is a social evaluation. They need to sit down with you, that person, face to face, eyeball to eyeball, and get some background history about that person to find out where that person have been and what influences have been impacting that person's life. An example would be a kid 14, 15 years old that has moved 4, 5, 10 times in the last 3, 4, 5, 6 years. That kid has not established, in most cases, a sense of identity, of belonging, have an in-group, buddies and friends that we do all the kind of things that we do with buddies and friends. So that kid is a loner. That kid is emotionally a high risk for substance abuse in our society. We all want to belong. And when you're constantly being uprooted and moved about, it's dangerous.